Hello, folks, and welcome to our discussion of the chapter on race and ethnicity. What I will do is try to talk about a subject that is not specifically dealt with in the chapter. But first, I just wanted to mention in general some things about race and ethnicity and what the differences are between them, because they are not exactly the same in the way we use them in sociology. Now, bear in mind, I'm talking about race and ethnicity in the United States. Not all countries have, for example, a concept of race. When I was in Central Africa a number of years ago, I was referred to as a European by everyone. And the first time somebody said that, I said, no, I'm not a European, I'm an American. And they said, well, then you're a European. To them, a European is anybody who is not a member of an African tribe. Because tribe is the most important form of identification in much of Africa. So to them, if you're not in a tribe, you are a European. That includes African Americans. When African Americans visit much of Africa, they are also called Europeans. That was a great disappointment to many African Americans who were thinking about moving to Africa, hoping that Africans would accept them as their own, only to arrive there and be referred to as Europeans because they were not members of any particular tribe. Race is a social construction. There is no such thing as race outside of it being a social construction. Now, that said, race is a very powerful social construction. It has led to things like slavery, colonialism, and other practices, genocide. Really, it's led to horrendous treatment of other human beings. So, although it is a construction, that does not mean that the consequences of that construction have not been very real and very devastating for many people in the United States. But continuing with what I was saying, if you go to India, there is no concept of race. In India, everything is caste. What caste are you in? Now, obviously, people in India, people in Africa, are aware of the American concept of race, just as we are aware of caste in India and tribe in Africa. It's just that that is not how they go about categorizing people. But in India, for example, with caste, they talk about castes which are low ranked. And there is a lot of effort by the Indian government to attempt to raise the status of low caste individuals. And in fact, there are some people from lower castes who are now in high-ranked positions, who make a lot of money, who work as physicians and attorneys and even CEOs of corporations. So gradually, people in low castes are increasing in their status. But there's a lot of resistance to that because in India, caste is connected to a religious concept called a varna, V-A-R-N-A. Avarna is mentioned in the Hindu religious scriptures, which are called the Vedas, V-E-D-A-S. And in the Vedas, the Varnas are described as occupations. Now, it is never said in the Vedas that these Varnas are hereditary, meaning that a person who is born into a particular family with a Varna will necessarily be in that Varna. But over time, that is the way it has developed. And so people, when they think of caste, they equate caste with a kind of religious obligation. That was not the case with race in the United States, and that is not the case, for the most part, with tribe in most of Africa. So each part of the world has its own form of social inequality. But we will be focused now on inequality in the United States. We'll talk about race in the United States, and then when we finish that, we will gradually move into ethnicity. And again, when we discuss ethnicity, we'll be talking about ethnicity in an American context. The approach that I will be using in presenting this is commonly called critical race theory. Critical race theory. Race in the United States began on the plantation system. On the plantation, you had three categories of people. You had the owners of the plantations, who were sometimes called blue bloods, the people who were the wealthy plantation owners. Then you had the black slaves. Then you had the rednecks. And as perhaps many of you know, the rednecks got that nickname, presumably, because they were working out in the sun and the backs of their necks got sunburned. Today, and even then, rednecks have worn the label redneck as a badge of pride. Outside of the South, the term redneck is often associated with prejudice or bigotry. That is not the case in the South. And I say that as someone who lived in the South for 17 years. Now, I am not originally from the South. I am originally from New York City. But I lived in the South for a long time. And I met people, many people, over the years, many of whom were my students, who called themselves rednecks. And what they mean by that is a country white person. Someone who likes to fish and hunt. Perhaps someone who lives in a trailer park. Perhaps someone who struggles to pay their monthly bills. But not somebody who is a bigot. The term bigotry is not really a part of the Southern definition of redneck. Now, that's not to say that many rednecks in the South aren't bigots. Some are and some are not. But that's not how people in the South understand redneck. Redneck is basically a country person, somebody who lives in a rural area and who does not make very much money. So you had the plantation owners, the slaves, and the rednecks. Now, economically, the slaves and the rednecks had a lot more in common with each other than either of them had with the plantation owners, the Blue Bloods. But what many historians, American historians, think is that the following situation most likely occurred in many parts of the South on various plantations. The plantation owners would call the rednecks to them, and in effect they would say something like, "Let's make a deal. We will give you a certain amount of status, the right to defend yourself in court," which they didn't have. "We will pay you more money. We will give you some property. We will give you additional rights that you don't have. In exchange for that, we would like you to become the foreman, the supervisors of the rednecks on the cotton fields." Now, historically, when people are offered power, they very, very rarely turn it down. There have been some exceptions, but by and large, people very rarely turn it down. And that was certainly the case with the rednecks. They accepted the deal. Some have called it, metaphorically, a deal with the devil. I don't mean the devil literally, but I mean metaphorically, that the plantation owners, as these people who really were these horrendous oppressors of slaves as well as rednecks, and the rednecks were offered some power, property, money, whatever, and they accepted it. So the rednecks became the supervisors of the slaves on the cotton fields. Now, you had the Civil War, the war between the states. Till this day, Southern historians and Northern historians explain the Civil War in a different way. Generally. Northern historians explain the Civil War as a war over slavery, which actually is what it was. Southern historians generally explain the war as a war over states' rights. Now, that is not incorrect exactly, but it's misleading, because it's, yeah, it's states' rights, but it's states' rights to have slaves. It's states' rights to own other human beings. But till this day, and again, I'm speaking as someone who lived in the South for 17 years, whenever you go into the average white person's home, you see a Confederate flag on the wall. And there is a saying in the South, "The South will rise again." So Southerners are generally very, very proud of being Southerners. And they generally have that same view that Southern historians do, that the Emancipation Proclamation, signed by President Abraham Lincoln, which over a period of time freed the slaves was a violation of states' rights. That's how they view it. Okay, so the slaves were freed. Now, what happened next? Well, the Blue Bloods, the plantation owners, were not really that badly affected by the freeing of the slaves for a variety of reasons. One is that a large number of slaves continued to live on the plantation. They really didn't know where else to go. That was the only home they had ever had. And perhaps sadly, many slaves, especially many female slaves, saw themselves as members of the slave owner's family. Many female slaves functioned as nannies for the slave owner's children. Now, whether after the Emancipation Proclamation, the slaves, former slaves, I guess, were suddenly paid is unknown. I would assume in some cases maybe, in other cases maybe not. I doubt they were paid that much, if at all, in most cases. But what happened by Lincoln signing the Emancipation Proclamation, the really significant part of that from the standpoint of race, is that it put the former slaves and the rednecks on more or less a level playing field. Suddenly, the only thing that the rednecks had that the slaves did not have, namely their freedom from enslavement, they no longer had, because the slaves were also free, at least technically. And so, we see the formation of the Ku Klux Klan and attempts by many white people, including rednecks, to keep black people in line. It wasn't until very recently in American history that a white person was ever successfully convicted of killing a black person. Let me tell you a little story about that. One time, this is before I moved to the South, when I was just visiting South Carolina, I knew this guy named Jack and his wife Hattie. And I was maybe 14, 15 years old. I thought Jack was quite old. In retrospect, he was probably quite a bit younger than I am right now. But regardless, I looked at Jack as being like an uncle, I guess. He and Hattie were both black. And what I liked about Jack was that Jack treated me as an ordinary human being. He didn't talk up to me. He didn't talk down to me. I remember the first time I ever encountered a black man in the South. It was an old black man. I was a kid. This black man addressed me as sir. Why? Fear. Fear of being killed. fear of being lynched. Jack did not have that fear. And people would always warn Jack, "Jack, you're taking a risk with your life." But Jack didn't care. Jack was Jack. One day, Jack was at a basketball game. Jack really liked basketball. And he got a seat in the front bleachers and got there early so he could sit in toward the front. And before the game started, a white deputy sheriff walked up to him and said, "Jack," everyone knew Jack, "Jack, I want your seat." Now, the average black person would say, "Yes, sir." Jack said, "No. I got here first. Find your own seat." The deputy sheriff repeated what he said again. And again, Jack said no. At that point, the deputy sheriff pulled out his revolver and shot Jack in the head. Jack was dead on the spot. According to protocol, the deputy sheriff was arrested. He was released from jail the following morning. No charges were pressed. And he was back in the sheriff's department that same day. Again, white people could kill black people more or less with impunity. Nothing happened to them. You can find photographs in books, in Google image search, in Bing image search, of white people holding a picnic with little kids, all smiling, and in the background is a black man hanging from a noose. And often the sheriff was there as well. It was a party because people didn't think of these black people as being human beings. Literally. They had totally dehumanized them. So literally it was a festival. A lynching was a festival many times. Okay. Let's continue. As I said, even though blacks had more in common with rednecks than they did with the plantation owners, to the rednecks, that deal that they had made stuck. And so, with the Ku Klux Klan, you had the enforcement arm of white people who were enforcing black compliance. If a black person stepped out of line, he or she might find a burning cross on his or her lawn, or even be lynched. Lynching was rampant all over the United States, but especially in the South. Especially, but not exclusively, in the South. So, that's basically what happened. That's how race started in the United States. Race started on the plantation system. And it was reinforced over the years after slavery with whites becoming, in effect, the enforcers many whites, not all, but many whites becoming the enforcers of black deference, black compliance with the wishes of white people, making sure that black people behaved in a way that they thought were appropriate. Was appropriate, I should say. So that's the origin of race. That's where race came from. Race in the United States has principally been an issue of black and white. Later on, other races were added, but originally, those were the original races. Certainly, Native Americans were oppressed, but originally they were not seen as a race. They were seen as a conquered people, but not as a race. The notion of race began with black people. So you had black people and white people, the two original races in the United States. Now, ethnicity. My family is Jewish. Non-religious Jews. Most Jews in New York City are non-religious. That is different, to my understanding, than Jews in this part of the country. I don't know any Jews personally in this part of the country, although I've met some casually. I don't know anybody. But my understanding is that Jews here are generally more religious. This is, after all, a part of the Bible Belt, which includes both the South and the Midwest. And the Bible Belt relates not only to Christians, but to Jews as well. But New York City, which is the largest Jewish city in the world, there are more Jews in New York City than there are in Tel Aviv or in Jerusalem. Literally, the largest Jewish city in the world. But most New York City Jews were like my family. They were not religious. They didn't follow anything. They didn't belong to a temple. They didn't follow the high holy days, usually. Once in a while they did, but not usually. They didn't follow the kosher laws. I grew up having bacon and eggs most mornings, which of course is a violation of kosher laws, to have anything with a pork product in it. My family didn't care. We were a secular or non-religious family, which, and in fact, all Jews I knew were secular or non-religious. I didn't meet any religious Jews until I was in my 20s. And even then, it was not really a very close meeting. It was just a casual meeting. So, when the Irish, when Italians, when Russians, when Poles came to this country, they were not viewed as white people. A white person was somebody, was an American of English ancestry. That was a white person. A white person was an Anglo-American, meaning an English-American. So, obviously, I'm not an English-American. My ancestry is from Russia, 75%, and Austria, 25%. But really, I'm just an Ashkenazi Jew, meaning a Middle European Jew. And my father, who's now dead, who was born in 1919, told me that when he was growing up, he was not seen as being white. Now, here's what happened. During World War II, you had whites, meaning Anglo-Americans, English-Americans, fighting alongside Jews, Irish, Italians, Poles, Russians, etc. And they realized that they had basically a lot in common. By that time, most Jews, Irish, Italians, and so on, had been so thoroughly blended, the sociological term is assimilated, which just means blended, into American culture, that they were basically indistinguishable from white people. And so suddenly, during and especially after World War II, Jews, Irish, Italians, Poles, and so on became white. As I said before, it is very rare that people who are offered power will turn that power down. And that was the case here. Now, it's hard for me to say what I would have done. I'm not living then. I would like to think I would have turned it down. I would like to think that. But I don't know. It's hard to say. I'm living in the 21st century now, so I wasn't around after World War II, so I don't know what I would have done then. But I hope I would not have accepted it. I hope I would have rejected it. But most people accepted it. That was the birth of ethnicity. So in the United States, ethnicity refers to white ethnics, what are called now white ethnics, which would include Ashkenazi Jews, which are Middle European Jews, Sephardic Jews, which are Spanish Jews. Sorry, my phone is going off, but I will get that call later. I forgot to turn the phone off. I apologize. It would include Italians. It would include Irish. It would include Poles. All of those would be regarded as being white ethnics. So the tent of whiteness expanded beyond Anglo-Americans to include a variety of other people who previously, like myself, were not considered as being white. Now, I would rather, honestly, I would rather be considered as brown. Now, I look white, I guess, but I would still rather be considered as brown. But I don't have that choice. I don't have that luxury. Regardless of whatever I think, when I go outside, people see me as white. So I benefit from white privilege. And I acknowledge that. Now, I don't want to benefit from white privilege. My feeling is, if everyone cannot be privileged, if everyone cannot have equality, if the fact is that African Americans are shot by the police at an astoundingly higher rate than white people, that's a lack of privilege. If black people don't have that privilege, I don't want that privilege either. I just don't want it. Literally, I don't want it. So that much I can say. But it's not my choice. I can say it, but my saying it has no impact. So, ethnicity in the United States, and again, we're only talking about the United States, ethnicity in the United States refers to white ethnics. People who previously were not considered white, but who now are. That concludes the lecture for this week. Have a good one.